Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to The Damage Report. I'm John Irola, big old show for you on today, which I believe is a Thursday. Really going with that. If it's still Wednesday, this week's gonna be rough on me. But anyway, we have a lot that we're gonna be talking about. Ryan Grimm is gonna be joining me a little bit later on, obviously contributed to the Young Turks, The Intercept as well. We're gonna be talking about some big news of the day, including Bernie Sanders' new immigration proposal. It is really something. We're gonna be giving you details on that. Bernie Sanders also launching an attack against Facebook after some new reporting of how they mishandled purposefully private data of their users for their own personal business interests. We're gonna have a congressional candidate joining us. Lindsey Graham goes further off the deep end and more. But before we get to all of that, we're gonna be starting off with the latest on William Barr. So far throughout this impeachment inquiry, William Barr has kept a relatively low profile, which has frustrated me to no end. The lack of attention to William Barr and his early efforts to avoid this scandal ever coming to light, which we will talk about. But there's some new reporting about William Barr and one way that he wouldn't help Donald Trump to get out from under this pressure he's facing. President Trump apparently wanted Attorney General William Barr to hold a news conference declaring that the commander in chief had broken no laws during a phone call in which he pressed his Ukrainian counterpart to investigate a political rival. Though Barr ultimately declined to do so, people familiar with the matter said. And so, when this was initially coming out, Donald Trump wanted William Barr to hold a formal press conference where he would just declare that he had done nothing wrong. And honestly, I sympathize a little bit with Donald Trump in how he had wanted that and then was stymied by William Barr, because I mean, why not? Back when the Mueller report was about to be released, William Barr decided to make his own Cliff Notes version of it, got out in front of it with a bunch of lies, a bunch of deception, and the media ran with it for a couple of days. And for all we know, that irreparably changed the public's perception of what the Mueller report eventually ended up actually containing. And so if he did it with Mueller, why not in this case? And yet William Barr refused to do that. The request for it, by the way, came around September 25th when the administration released a rough transcript or summary transcript of the phone call between Zelensky and Trump. And so I don't know if they say it came around that time. I don't know if it came a few days before, a few days after. I'm imagining after, because Donald Trump really did seem to believe that releasing that transcript was gonna end this thing, and nothing did more to throw fuel on the fire of the impeachment inquiry, what would eventually become the impeachment inquiry, then releasing that transcript. So that was clearly not enough. Perhaps a press conference would have been enough to back the pressure off of him. And that might seem crazy or naive considering where we now are. I mean, it really does look like he's going to be impeached now, but that's not what it looked like on September 25th or that week. At that point, Nancy Pelosi, she still did not believe that impeachment was warranted, thought it would be too dangerous when it came to the election. Dozens and dozens and dozens of Democratic representatives in the House hadn't yet come out in favor of impeachment. We were still being pitched as crazy people for thinking it would ever happen. And yet it indeed did, although it might not have if William Barr had given him what he wanted. Now, what's interesting about this, and we're gonna get into Trump's denial that this happened, his attacks against the reporters at the Washington Post who came out with this. But apparently Trump not only asked him to do this, but he's been whining about it ever since, which makes it way easier for anonymous sources to eventually leak the information. The president has mentioned Barr's demurral to associates in recent weeks, saying he wished Barr would have held the news conference. You idiot, it was an attempted cover up and you keep complaining about it. That's, he's really bad at this, okay? It almost makes you believe that whole he's too dumb to quid pro quo thing. But anyway, we return to Donald Trump, who is responding to this reporting coming out, saying things like, Bill Barr did not decline my request to talk about Ukraine. The story was a fake Washington Post con job with an anonymous source that doesn't exist. Just read the capitalized transcript. The Justice Department already ruled that the call was good. We don't have freedom of the press. That is true. The Justice Department did put out a formal press release saying the call was good. But anyway, what's interesting about that tweet is, like, you start to get distracted by all the nonsense later on. But look again at that first sentence. Bill Barr did not decline my request to talk about Ukraine. No, that's the second tweet. But so you did ask him to do it, right? And he didn't do it. So he seems to have declined. You asked him to do something that makes you look really bad. You're admitting that on social media, and he didn't end up doing it. Unless it was just a press conference that nobody showed up to. I don't know. That gets into like the Zen koan of the tree in the woods thing. But anyway, that had the admission. He did double down, saying the story in the Amazon Washington Post, of course, picked up by the fake news. By fake news CNN, saying President Trump asked for AG Barr to hold a news conference clearing him on Ukraine is totally untrue and just another fake news story with anonymous sources that don't exist. The lamestream media, which is the enemy of the people, is working overtime with made up stories in order to drive dissension and distrust. So just brief mention, because I feel like we should never actually normalize this. When he feels pressure from a major news organization for doing reporting that makes him look bad, he once again went back to calling them the enemy of the people. So if you don't like the Washington Post, the president feels like maybe you should take that into your own hands and do something about it, because it's your enemy, capitalized, the enemy of you and all of the other people. And by the way, what a Orwellian place we've gotten to. Those two tweets I just saw, the first and then the continuation. I mean, he throws in fake news CNN, that Amazon owns the Washington Post. The sources aren't made up, the lamestream media, the enemy of the people. All we're at as a people now is just a series of fake, deceptive, propagandistic catchphrases. And you just string those together with the occasional verb. And that is a communique from the president, official communication. He again said, now there's a reason I'm reading multiple of these. He says, the degenerate Washington Post made up the story about me asking Bill Barr to hold a news conference. Never happened, and there were no sources. So that's interesting for two reasons. One, the idea that the Washington Post had a meeting of all of their staff, and they're like, what would be a good story? Let's say he asked Barr to shut it down. And also to claim that that happened after two tweets earlier, you said that you asked him to do it. Really bizarre. I can't make heads or tails of it, but perhaps a Trump supporter actually could. Now, the reason I read that he's done multiple tweets about this is that this reaction that he's having to this story is really strong. He's really incensed by it, and it reminds me, perhaps it reminds you, of how he responded to the story about James Comey being fired. Under seemingly very similar circumstances. With James Comey, he desperately wanted him to publicly clear him of any of the sort of shadow that was hanging over his presidency relatively early on in the months after his inauguration. That whole fight, by the way, did not work out well for Donald Trump. It is what, after all, launched the Mueller report. He also had a similar relationship with Jeff Sessions. Jeff Sessions committed one sin in the eyes of Donald Trump, and that was that he was not sufficiently loyal in publicly clearing Donald Trump of all of the accusations against him. And again, I'll go back to the core principle of fascism is loyalty to the individual. Donald Trump demands that. That is what he wants. And William Barr here is not being sufficiently loyal. Now, Trump has not thrown him under the bus yet. He hasn't fired him either, perhaps because William Barr has been very helpful to Donald Trump since he came into the administration. I mean, that was his only qualification, was that he would do what Sessions and Comey would not. We know, I already talked about what he did during the Mueller report. And it will be interesting to watch in the near future how that relationship plays out, because Barr did what he could initially before we even knew about this story to make sure that we never found out about it. When the whistleblower put forward his initial complaint, the DOJ crushed it. They were like, there's nothing to this. We're not going to do any interviews. We don't care. There's nothing here. And under normal circumstances, that might have led to this story never happening. because we wouldn't be talking about any of this because we wouldn't know about any of this. Thankfully, the whistleblower did not let it die there, and thus we end up where we're at. But William Barr, a guy who is implicated in this scandal, although nobody pays attention to it, from day one, before day one, has been trying to shut down any investigation into it. That is a massive conflict of interest, a conflict of interest that continues to this day because William Barr still heads the DOJ. And while he might have done the right thing in not doing this press conference, he's still there as a loyal Trump supporter who believes that his position as AG has nothing to do with an obligation to the American people and everything to do with an obligation to protect Donald Trump. He needs to be brought into this. Democrats should be talking about William Barr. They should be making sure that he either is recused from this entire investigation, anything having to do with it, or is replaced by someone who actually understands what the position of AG is meant to accomplish. So far, we haven't gotten there, but God, I really hope that we have some movement in that direction. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. When we come back, Ryan Grimm is gonna be joining us to break down some of the big news of the day after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un*** the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Un*** the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today. And get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Today, Bernie Sanders is out with his immigration plan, and it is really something. There's a lot to it. We can't go in depth into everything, but to give an idea of how all-encompassing it is, it includes a call for the breakup of ICE and CBP, redistributes their functions to their proper authorities, reinstates and expands DACA, ends for-profit detention, calls for a full demilitarization of the border, obviously does not have funds for a wall, withholds federal contracts from employers found to be exploiting guest workers, ends workplace raids, and provides a legal path to citizenship within 5 years, among a number of other components. So this is really something. And joining us now to break this down, Washington Bureau Chief for The Intercept and contributor to TYT, Ryan Grimm. Welcome back to The Damage Report.
Great to be back here.
Great to have you here. And we've certainly got something to dig into. What do you make of Sanders' immigration proposal?
Well, I think the left deserves a lot of credit for targeting ICE as an institution itself, and then after that, roping in CBP. I mean, the Border Patrol is in some ways worse and more dangerous agency than ICE, if you can believe that. But ICE has a name that's easier to circulate among the public, and so I think that's almost one reason that ICE became more commonly known than CBP. But credit where it's due, you know, the focus is now on both of them, and the focus is on their rotten institutional culture. You know, it shows that progressives are starting to think about actually governing and running institutions. You know, when an institution is so thoroughly rotten to its core that its culture has just gone rogue, there aren't reforms that you can do to kind of move it in the right direction, because the culture is going to continue to drive it in the malignant direction that it's headed. And that is absolutely the case with ICE and CBP. The Intercept has done some reporting on this. ProPublica has done some reporting on this. You might remember that famous Facebook group That had even the head of CBP in it, sharing just completely disgusting racist memes about Ocasio-Cortez, other members of Congress, and about migrants. It showed just how racist the culture was. And once the culture has become that toxic, the only thing you can do to move forward is to burn it to the ground and build something new in its place. And what Sanders proposes is to move its various functions where they belong. Citizenship would be under the State Department. That makes sense. That's what the State Department does. Border crossings and violations of immigration law would go with law enforcement, the Department of Justice. That, like, again, that makes sense. You know, after 2001, the September 11th attacks, that's when CBP and ICE were kind of broken out and given this separate law enforcement authority. And so, you know, we're far enough removed from that attack that we can now rationally look back and say, did this work? No, it didn't. So let's start something new.
Yeah, it's really something. I think that you're right to point out that it has a focus on institutions that's really necessary for not just communicating values in this area, but making sure that you have a path to actually do something about it once you become president. He acknowledges the need to make liberal use of executive orders and executive actions to get some of this done. And also, topically, while there is, you know, a lot of obviously respect for human rights, current human rights abuses against these communities and path to legalization, all of that, there's also a big focus on the economic rights of these individuals, fighting against inequality and exploitation of these communities. That's very much in line with Bernie Sanders' overall political philosophy.
And this, I think, is the best that a populist argument can do and still be moral and humane in combating the right-wing populism that Trump relies on. Like, right now, a lot of the building trade unions and a lot of people involved in construction and manual labor are extremely happy with Donald Trump. You know, wages for the first time are up. There's a ton of work, a ton of stuff is being built. And I think at some level, some workers connect Trump's anti-immigrant message with rising wages. And they say, see, look, you know, we've been saying for years that all of these brown people streaming across the border were driving down our wages. Now we have somebody who's talking about a wall all the time, and all of a sudden our wages are going up. That's the populist right wing message. And the counter to that is that, no, you know, if you believe that immigrants are pushing down wages, the only reason that would be true is because the legal regime puts them in a separate class where they are utterly able to be exploited by bosses. They can't fight for their own rights. They can't unionize. They can't complain if their wages are stolen. They can't complain if they're being paid less than minimum wage because of the threat of violence and deportation against them. So if you give rights to that class and you bring them on a level to the rest of the working class, then you can't pit the elements of the working class against each other. And that's precisely why unions have always said that one of their biggest demands in NAFTA is that the Mexican government raise wages in Mexico. And that might sound counterintuitive to people. Shouldn't American unions focus on American wages? But no, if you can elevate Mexican wages, then companies don't have the opportunity to flee across the border.
Exactly.
And capture that cheap labor. And that's before you even get to the concept and the value of solidarity.
100%. And I think it's going to be a very popular plan. Hopefully, it'll drive some conversation around this topic and get other candidates to make clear what they plan to do in this area. Mm-hmm. So let's turn now to a very different area. The Netflix show Patriot Act, hosted by Hassan Minhaj, a while back had an episode that's very critical of Saudi Arabia, the Saudi government, and the Saudi government started complaining about it almost immediately, which Minhaj noted, saying, of all the Netflix originals, the only show that Saudi Arabia thinks violates Muslim values is the one hosted by a Muslim, which is ironic. But was also successful because of their complaining, Netflix has decided to pull that episode from Saudi Arabia, which seems to miss the entire point of that episode and that show and what he's trying to do politically. But it shows that they're willing to bow down when an authoritarian regime complains. What do you make of that, Ryan?
Yeah, and it validates the entire point he made. Credit to Bernie Sanders, who last night on Twitter unleashed on Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman over this decision, saying that a murderous dictator who tortures women who are protesting for the right to drive, who murders journalists, should not be dictating what content American companies produce. And yeah. I can't imagine a more obvious statement to make. Yet it counts for political courage in today's atmosphere. If you want a reason for a Green New Deal and you're not satisfied by all the ones that are out there, getting off fossil fuels and getting off of dependence with this kleptocracy in Saudi Arabia is as good a reason as any.
I certainly agree. Now, Netflix has responded to the criticism for them pulling the episode. And basically, they make the point that Saudi Arabia has only really complained about this one episode. They allow other shows that propagate liberal values. They mention the show's sexual education, that sort of thing. And they say that effectively we can accomplish more by focusing on entertainment than trying to speak truth to power. It seems a little bit self-serving to me. And when they say they can accomplish more, I don't know exactly what they mean that they're trying to accomplish, because they did, after all, bow down to a dictatorship. Do you think that it's on them as an entertainment company to be making these sorts of decisions to stand up for American values when they are an international corporation?
Yeah, and they're not just American values. They're the international human values.
Yeah.
And everybody has an ethical obligation to stand up for those. What Saudi Arabia wants to create and what Netflix is saying is okay is an authoritarian dictatorship that allows some entertainment that isn't completely dictated to the public by the royal family, but that otherwise, absolutely no criticism of the regime will be tolerated. And this is a regime that not just is butchering journalists, but it's torturing and slaughtering not just dissidents and activists, but people who, as 17-year-olds who post something slightly critical of the royal family on Twitter, will be dragged out of their apartments and executed, never seen from again.
Yeah.
It's just an absolutely horrifyingly evil regime, and their argument is that as long as they make some modest reforms and allow women to drive and allow some Western entertainment into the country, that the bargain should be that they should be completely immune from criticism.
And, yeah.
That all you're doing is propping up that
exactly.
regime.
Yeah, and look, I guess I should reach out to some of the activists inside of Saudi Arabia and ask them if they are okay with losing their ability to distribute materials that are critical of the government, but on the other hand, they get to watch BoJack Horseman. Maybe that's okay. I don't know.
Right. And you're reaching out to them, maybe intercepted by spies at Twitter. They just indicted two Saudi spies who were working for Twitter and snooping on dissident accounts, or it may otherwise be surveilled, and the dissidents may wind up tortured and executed just for one of us reaching out to them.
Exactly.
Horribly dystopian situation.
Yeah. So we don't have much time, but I do want your impressions on one last story, and that is that Bill Gates was recently asked about some of the wealth tax proposals that are going around, and he addressed Elizabeth Warren's in particular, saying that if I had to pay $20 billion, it's fine. But when you say I should pay $100 billion, then I'm starting to do a little math about what I have left over. And I would respond by saying, I think you should do the math first, because nobody's asking you to pay $100 billion. It's a 6% tax. How many trillions of dollars do you have? But he's indicating there that there's a limit to how far he's willing to go with these tax reforms. What do you think about that?
Right. Maybe he shouldn't have dropped out of Harvard. He could have taken a basic statistics class. Mm-hmm. Although some people are calling for more of his wealth to be taken, me, for instance, take more of it. But yeah, the argument that is often made in defense of billionaires is, look at Bill Gates. You know, he's a nice guy. You know, he's curing HIV. He's doing all this great work around the world. Here's what's crazy about Bill Gates, that, you know, he famously retired 15, 20 years ago or so, and announced very publicly that he was going to, you know, spend the rest of his life giving his money away. And to a large extent, he has done that. Yet today he is richer than the day he stopped working and began giving all his money away.
That's crazy.
Which just shows you just the value of compound interest and passive income, and how the rich just continue to get richer without doing anything at all. And so, he's one more billionaire that is objecting to a billionaire tax, and one more reason that we should have one.
Yeah, and look, obviously he's done a number of good things. I have a friend I went to college with who worked with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in Africa to fight HIV. Like, he does good things, which I am willing to give him warm thoughts for. I'm not willing to give him a lifetime cessation on tax reform, especially when
and he's supplanted government. You know, he's his own private government in all of these countries, and in our own country, he dictates health and education policy. He may be doing it from a magnanimous, benevolent perspective, but it's utterly undemocratic. Yeah. Sorry, what were you saying?
Well, I was just going to say, especially when a follow-up question was asked about if it was Warren and Donald Trump, who would you support? And he, at best interpretation, was vacillated and wasn't clear, but he seemed perfectly willing to support Donald Trump if a wealth tax was the alternative.
Yeah, and it's revealing that somebody like him wouldn't just automatically say, no, I'm not going to vote for Donald Trump, and list the obvious reasons why it's wrong to support Donald Trump. You know, he clearly has more money than he's ever going to be able to spend his entire life, but because there's a 6% tax on his wealth thrown out there, all of a sudden now he's wavering, or he actually would vote for Warren, and he's afraid of alienating the far right elements that support Trump, which isn't very impressive either. Because, you know, he said I would vote for the person who would bring the most professionalism to the White House, and that's not a very impressive code.
No,
I mean, they're clearly, out of Elizabeth Warren and Donald Trump, one of those is professional, and the other just is Donald Trump. So he did seem to be hinting that even despite the wealth tax, he would vote for Warren because he thinks Trump is unprofessional. But the unwillingness to come out and just say that is also revealing.
Yeah, yeah. I expect that, considering the strike back, he's probably going to have to release a second statement that's a little bit more clear. But Ryan Grimm, thank you so much as always for joining us on the Damage Report.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, Bernie Sanders speaking out against some of the recent revelations involving Facebook and your private data after this. Bernie Sanders had strong words for Facebook after new reporting showing that the company has, for a very long time, used, on the one hand, your private data to get app developers to give them preferential deals to make money, while at the same time trying to convince you that they have a lot of respect for your private information. And the senator said, Facebook has incredible power over the economy and our political life. It harvests the data of 228 million Americans and over uses the sensitive information in dangerous ways. What we need is vigorous antitrust action and to break Facebook up. Now, I'm going to give you the details on the reporting in case you haven't seen it, but note that he's not just criticizing them and he's not just calling for investigations. He's saying they need to be broken up, which is about as far as any politician in America has gone. Warren had attacked Facebook a little bit and received a ton of strike back from Zuckerberg, who apparently was allying with Buttigieg to oppose her. And so we'll have to see how he responds to Bernie Sanders. But let me tell you about this actual reporting. So Facebook apparently gave Amazon special access to user data because it was spending money on Facebook advertising. In another case, the messaging app MessageMe was cut off from access to data because it had grown too popular and could compete with Facebook. And I can't say for sure, but I'm imagining that the threshold for becoming too popular is pretty low, because I've never heard of that app in my entire life, but apparently it was too big and it was becoming a threat to Mark Zuckerberg. But also notice there, when they said they gave them special access to user data because they were spending money on advertising, you are probably thinking, as we talk about this story, wait, aren't they also in the news for allowing Donald Trump and other politicians to lie in their ads? Yes, and I am worried about the precedent they've set with these companies, where if you spend enough money in ads, we will not only allow you to lie, but potentially give you access to private user data while lying to our user base about whether you can see that information or not. So we know about this because of a lawsuit. They got this trove of documents, thousands and thousands of documents, 7,000 pages in total, internal communications, emails, web chats, all of that. And in it, we found out that some employees at Facebook were bringing up their concerns about this. Doug Purdy, who was the director of product for Facebook at the time, described Zuckerberg as a master of leverage. Others said that it was basically Facebook had become a cast of Game of Thrones villains. One employee said that the competitive bucketing that Facebook was attempting to achieve with its platform is, quote, more than complicated, it's sort of unethical. With another agreeing, that feels unethical somehow. It just makes me feel like a bad person. Thank you for noting that. Do something about it while you can, because it's not just sort of unethical, it's wildly unethical and probably should be illegal if it isn't already. But what's even worse than that is, while they're doing all of these deals with different apps and using your information as a bargaining chip with them, specifically to make money, they're also lying to you about it. So Facebook was planning to publicly frame those exact deals as a way to protect user privacy. I don't know how they were going to do that, but apparently he's a master manipulator, so maybe he was going to come up with something. That's the bad news. All this reporting is the bad news. The good news is that in addition to national politicians like Bernie Sanders, who are calling for more accountability and potentially splitting up Facebook, state level efforts against the company have been proceeding as well. Facebook has apparently been under investigation by California officials over its privacy practices for more than a year, with State Attorney General Xavier Becerra saying on Wednesday they may be forced to turn over key documents. Becerra said the Attorney General's office had been investigating since spring of last year whether Facebook violated California law by deceiving users and misrepresenting its privacy practices, and that the company has continued to drag its feet and refuse to comply with the requests. In October, New York Attorney General Letitia James announced that 47 attorneys general from states and US territories plan to take part in a New York-led antitrust probe into Facebook. So their strategy at this point is to deceive you about what they're doing behind the scenes, and when it comes to official investigations, to drag their feet, not cooperate, not provide documents, and all of that. They can do that to a point, especially considering how much money they have, their donations to politicians, all of that. But once you get effectively all of these states' attorneys general across the entirety of our country, it should become a little bit harder to do that. And if we have the right politician leading our country and making sure that we keep the pressure on Facebook to do what it has always promised us it would do in regard to our private information, maybe some of those state level investigations can get to the bottom of what Facebook has been doing, and we can have some actual substantive reforms. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, Christopher Armitage is gonna join us, congressional candidate for Washington's 5th district. We're gonna break down that race after this. Joining us now is congressional candidate for Washington's 5th district, Christopher Armitage. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, John. I appreciate it. I'm really excited to talk to you and tell some more people about our little neck of the woods and the bigger picture of it all.
I'm very excited about that as well. So why don't we start with your neck of the woods? Give us an idea of what the 5th district is like.
Well, it's Eastern Washington. So we have the second biggest city in the state of Washington, Spokane, but it's actually 25% bigger than New Jersey. We have 10 counties, but 2/3 of the population is in one of those counties. So it's very economically diverse. It's a rapidly growing community. It's a place that I love. I was stationed here at our Air Force base for 2 enlistments, and just this is my home. Mm-hmm. I love it.
Now, in terms of politics, my impression as an outsider, I've never visited the area. I've heard things about the Spokane area is that it does lean a little bit more conservative. And we should make note that the incumbent is a Republican. So tell us a little bit about the political makeup of that area.
Yeah, you know, we were actually on the red to blue list that the DCCC put out in 2018, and it looked like we were going to be a flippable district. And we ran a Hillary Clinton light type candidate, someone who spent all their time in the two major towns that are in our 10 counties. They did private fundraisers and public speaking engagements. A lot of people felt ignored. And it's not just money that wins these races. And like I said, this community is really diverse. When you travel up and down the district, I mean, in some of these rural counties, we've done events, and you'd be amazed how many serious, rabid progressives show up and are ready to actually win this race.
Okay, so tell us now about how you're going to differentiate yourself from the 2018 effort. So what is your race going to be like? How did you get into this?
Yeah, well, personally, I've made the pledge not to take any corporate money. I think it's important that we walk the walk. One of my big frustrations with our 2018 candidate was when she took corporate money. A big reason why I decided to run was, as a working class guy, I can't give my vote to someone who's going to use my healthcare, my family's healthcare, my community's healthcare as a bargaining chip for political gain. And that's just way too many people who get into politics. Mm-hmm. So this isn't really something I pictured for myself in my life, but I think that we deserve to be represented by one of us. You know, I've made minimum wage in the last few years. I've avoided going to the doctor as I had strep throat and I'm sweating through pillows, but I'd never had strep throat before, so I didn't know if that's what it was. And so I was avoiding going to the doctor because who knows what kind of bill I'm gonna get. Meanwhile, when I was active duty military, I was deployed to the border of Iraq and Kuwait, and I was helping family members with their copays for medical bills.
Wow.
That's not fair. Nobody should have to go through that.
Certainly not. And so obviously you're coming from a different place than the previous attempt to unseat Kathy McMorris Rogers, coming from a very different place than Rogers especially. And so what has she represented for the district? I know that she takes a lot of money from corporations, something you're not gonna do, especially from dirty energy corporations. So what has she been for the district over the past few years?
She's been an absentee. She votes with Trump 95% of the time.
Wow.
She shows up. She's not well liked. Even conservatives out here don't like her because they feel like she's not defending Trump enough. Or, you know, a lot of our conservatives in this district are more libertarian leaning, and she's a more evangelical Republican. So she kind of on both sides, people really don't like her. She regularly has two or three Republican challengers. And so, you know, she's voted against the ACA 50 times. Wow. We have rural hospitals up and down this district. They were not turning a profit. They were losing money every single year until the ACA. Now, every time she's voted against the ACA, she's voted against our rural hospitals. You know, I experienced universal single-payer healthcare in the military, and it was great. I never worried. Please, anyone out there who knows someone in the military, no matter how conservative they are, ask them, do you feel cheated out of private insurance? Because mm-hmm. They don't.
You know, you've been propagandized to. You didn't know how little choice you actually had while you were in there.
How dare I?
Exactly. So you've pointed out now that you've got in that area, you described them as rabid progressives. You also have some disaffected conservatives. So when you're out there and you're campaigning, what are some of the issues that you're focusing on to try to bring in either one or the other or both of those groups?
Well, you know, Medicare for All is very popular, even among our farming and rural communities. Underemployment and unemployment, especially in 5 of our 10 counties, are a massive, well, the underemployment in every county, but unemployment in some of our counties is over 10%. Mm-hmm. And that's just the people who are actively unemployed, haven't been out of the workforce for years. People need good jobs. That's why in our district, we're hosting Green New Deal forums. I'm a member of the Sunrise Movement. I helped organize the climate strike out here. We had 1,000 people in downtown Spokane show up for the climate strike. It was incredible. And so we're working with the Sunrise Movement to hold Green New Deal forums in every one of these counties and communicate to the rural communities how this is going to be the greatest economic stimulus package since since World War II. It's going to rebuild our middle class. It's going to give people the chance to not just have jobs, but have good jobs. And that's a core part of my platform, is communicating to people.
Yeah.
And even though, you know, in our district, I mean, we have some people who, you know, we had a state representative who is in our district who wrote a conservative manifesto basically calling for any man who's pro-choice to be killed. And we have armed conservative militias out here that are pretty serious. And that person who wrote that manifesto, who's a state representative from here, he was reported to the FBI for that by our Trump-supporting sheriff.
Wow.
And so it's pretty intense, but there's so much pushback. People are ready for the change. It's just, we're not going to get there if we keep running candidates that people have to hold their nose when they vote for.
Yeah.
People want to vote for one of us. And that's what happens, is everywhere we go in this community, we're seeing that when you listen to people, regardless of where they are on the spectrum, I see that we have more in common. I have more in common with them. Our campaign has more in common with them than their current representation. We're getting back to the working class core of this. And so we actually had a Speaker of the House from this district, Tom Foley. He lost his seat in 94 in the red wave after the assault weapons ban, and he is still a legend in this district. He was elected first in 1962, and the legend has it that he won by going to every single small town tavern and shaking hands with everyone in that tavern, no matter how conservative, and saying, "I'm Tom Foley and I'm running for the US House of Representatives."
Well, you better start hitting up some taverns there. But anyway, it's been great getting a chance to know a little bit about you, Christopher, and your candidacy. If people would like to find out more about what you want to accomplish, if you get into the House, where can they go to find out more?
I'd recommend going to armitageforcongress.com, ArmitageFor congress.com. And please consider contributing, you know, monthly recurring contribution of any amount. It's all grassroots, and a lot of the establishment out here doesn't believe that you can run a viable campaign without corporate money. We're here to prove them wrong. And in 2020, we will win. We're earning votes out there every day, and we get to replace a Republican with someone who supports the Green New Deal, single-payer Medicare for all, tuition-free universities and trade schools. And I also want to mention, if I ever get the chance publicly, I totally support any TYT pledges that you guys want to throw my way.
That would be awesome. Well, we have the economic pledge. Maybe we can talk about that sometime.
Cool. Thanks, John.
Okay. Thank you, Christopher. And good luck with the run.
Appreciate it.
We're going to take one last break here. When we come back, a little bit on Lindsey Graham continuing to dip, dodge, and weave, not wanting to make clear why he continues to stick with the president when more and more evidence is coming out involving this Ukraine scandal. We'll have his latest media appearance after this. Lindsey Graham has said weeks ago that he would have an open mind on this whole quid pro quo thing, that he would take a look at the evidence and decide where he stands based on that. Well, now would be a good time to demonstrate it, because earlier this week, Ambassador to the EU Gordon Sondland reversed his prior testimony, admitting now that yes, it was a quid pro quo. That's huge news. Let's see how the senator responds to it.
Bill Taylor, what does he base his belief that there's a quid pro quo on? What is the factual basis? A conversation with Sunderland. Now, here's a question. Why did Sunderland change his testimony? Was there a connection between Sunderland and Democratic operatives on the committee? Did he talk to Schiff? Did he talk to Schiff staffers? I've been a lawyer for a very long time. When somebody changes their testimony, they suddenly recall something they didn't know before. It makes me incredibly suspicious. Why did Sunderland change his mind? What prompted him to change his mind about maybe there was a quid pro quo when I said there wasn't?
Okay, so yes, when someone changes their testimony, it is suspicious, and we then have to divine why did they change what they said. Now, yes, hypothetically, this Republican mega donor could be a huge Adam Schiff fan, and maybe that's why he changed his mind. Or it could be that he was lying before, and other witnesses who have come forward have made it clear that he was not being honest. He worries now about being charged with perjury and potentially going to jail to join Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort. And so maybe that's why he's changing his testimony. Just a consideration, put that out there. The thing is, for Lindsey Graham to sit there and say that this guy, Sondland, who literally gave Donald Trump $1 million for his inauguration committee, to be secretly colluding with the Democrats is interesting, considering some of the things that prominent Republicans have said about Sondland in the past. I got a quote from a huge Sondland fan. You might know Donald J. Trump, who said, "I would love to send Ambassador Sondland, a really good man and great American, to testify, but something, something, a bunch of lies." But there, he's a good man and a great American. So how dare Lindsey Graham besmirch his great name? And that, of course, demonstrates that for Donald Trump, whether he likes or hates a person is entirely dependent on what they can do for him. But anyway, so let's bear that in mind. This is not some Democratic operative. It was an ambassador who was chosen by Donald Trump, who gave $1 million to Donald Trump. What really explains what you just saw with Lindsey Graham is not actual honest suspicion over the changing testimony of Sondland. It's that he doesn't care about any of this, that he's not taking it seriously. That is very clear in a couple of different ways. On the one hand, you have him saying that he's not gonna read any of the transcripts. "I've written the whole process off. I think this is a bunch of BS," after weeks of saying he wants to see what's in the transcripts. I would say even better evidence that he's not taking this process seriously is that, did you notice that as you were listening to all of his criticisms of Sondland, did you ever think, wait, this guy's name isn't Sondland, it's Sondland, and how does this US senator not know what his name is? And so Lindsey Graham is a joke. He's treating this as a joke, but that doesn't make it go away. Maybe start taking it seriously, because a presidency could depend on it. Anyway, thank you, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.